Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Great Scientists, Episode 4. We're actually making our way through this on page 64. We've just done Newton, and now we're going to Carolus Linnaeus. So he's the famous botany person, species chap, Swedish chap. And so I'll read this. Sometimes known in Sweden as the Flower King, Carolus Linnaeus, 1707 to 1778, was the great 18th century botanist who devised a system all scientists use today, classifying living things into species and classes, the two-part Latin name, which is sums him up quite a lot. He looks quite a sort of fun guy. He doesn't look as though he'd bite your head off or a bit ugly or anything like that. Okay. In the 17th century, botanists and zoologists from Europe were just beginning to discover the incredible diversity of natural life in the world. Some were beginning to look at plants and animals around them with the close interest inspired by the scientific revolution of the age. Others studied exotic plants and animals and brought them back from distant places ships were now visiting. The more botanists and zoologists looked at nature, or rather creation, as it was often called, the more confusing its teeming range of seemed to be to them. When people wrote books or treatises on animals, there seemed to be no other way to classify them but alphabetically, and there was no way of distinguishing the real from the mythical. Books on animals or bestiaries might begin with antelopes, move on to onto apes, and then Erophagus, whatever that is. It might be the order in English, but the order in each language would be often, of course, be different. The first great attempt to sort out the chaos was made by the English botanist John Ray, 1627 to 1705. In 1671, Ray went on an extensive spectrum gathering trip through Europe with his zoologist friend Francis Willoughby. Unfortunately, Willoughby died shortly after their return, but Ray carried on their work. Ray came up with a scheme of classifying all plants and animals. His brief Methicus Plantarum, 1682, provided the first definition of a species as a set of individuals who give rise through reproduction to new individuals similar to themselves. In this Historia Plantarum, Ray, for the first time, grouped species scientifically according to their structure. Linnaeus took up where Ray left off to create a definitive system of nature half a century later. Linnaeus was not alone in trying to find a classification system. By 1799, over 50 schemes had been proposed, but Linnaeus's system had two key features that guaranteed its survival. First of all, Linnaeus grouped plants according to their sexual ones, that is, the parts of the plants involved in reproduction. Secondly, he gave each species two-part Latin names, such as Liana Boreas, the marsh tinflower, part of the honeysuckle family, and named after the great botanist himself. The first part always referred to the name of the group it belongs to. The second part of the species, it's a species name. This system was so powerful and effective that it was adopted by botanists around the world by the end of the century and remained in place ever since. A Swedish childhood. Carolus Linnaeus was born in 1707 by the shores of Lake Monachlin in southeastern Sweden. Well, you know, what I was going to say is, I wonder how true that is, that he was actually born actually but on the shores, or was he born in a house which is near the shores? This is my thing. Later in life, he recalled it as one of the most beautiful places in Sweden. When one sits in the sun and listens to the cuckoo and the songs of all the other birds and the chirping and humming of insects, when one looks at the shining, gaily coloured flowers, one completely is stunned by the incredible resourcefulness of the Creator. Yet at school, young Carolus showed little interest in either botany or theology, and that his father thought to apprentice him as a shoemaker. Fortunately, a perceptive schoolmaster suggested go to Uppsala University as a medical student. At Uppsala, Leonis was immediately captivated by the demonstration performed on the aging botanist Olof Celsius in the university's botanical gardens. Indeed, Leonis' interests became so avid that in 1732, and when he was 25, he was sent by the Uppsala Science Society to gather specimens in Lapland. He was thoroughly delighted with what he found there, and his finds included the small white Arctic flower, Leonis borealis, the Leonis of the North, which is his trademark. A most famous portrait of him shows him wearing the white flower and festooned with traditional items of the Sami people of Lapland. His findings there were later published in a book called Flora Laponica in 1737, Cataloguing Creation. When he returned south, Leonis went to the Netherlands to finish his medical studies. Whilst there, he studied the incredible range of plants in the gardens of Beieren by the wealthy banker George Clifford. He also met Peter Atreidi, another young, enthusiastic naturalist. Together they conceived a plan to classify all creation. Andrea was to study the fishes and land animals, and Leonis the birds and plants. Sadly, Andrea just fell into an outstanding canal and drowned, so it was left to Leonis to continue the project alone. Leonis' basic scheme was sketched out in a little pamphlet called Systema Naturalia, Systems of Nature, which he published in Holland in 1735. Quote, in these three pages, Leonis explained, is handled the great analogy which is found between plants and animals in their increase in like measure according to their kind, and what I have simply written, I pray, may be favorably received. Plant 6. What Leonis was talking about with his talk of the analogy between plants and animals was the sexual nature of plants. A few decades before, German botanist Rudolf Camerius had shown that no seed would grow without being first pollinated. Then, in 1717, the French botanist Sébastien Villant had lectured on the sexuality of plants, including pistachio plants, in the Jardin du Roi in Paris. To make his point, Leonis took up his idea. In 1729, Leonis wrote a paper called Spondylus Plantarum, in which he wrote about the betrothal of plants, in which a perfect analogy with animals is concluded. Variant had talked about just petals when talking about a flower's sexual organs. Leonis insisted that the stamens were the pollinators made, the bridegrooms, and pistils and seeds were made, the brides, that are the real sexual organs. Brides and bridegrooms. Taking Ray's idea of species are basically living things through that reproduce together, Leonis proceeded to develop a scheme based entirely on the sexual equipment of plants. He divided all flowering plants into 23 classes according to the length and number of stamens, their male organs, and then subdivided these into orders according to the number of petals, female organs, they possessed. There was a 24th class, the Cryptogramia, which included plant-like mosses, which appeared to have no flowers. Many people were hugely offended by the sexual overtones of Leonis' scheme. One class he named Diandra, meaning two husbands in one marriage, while he said the calyx might be regarded as a Libra Majora, or the foreskin. One could regard the corolla, Labia Mala, indeed. Some found it so shocking that most of the century botany was not seen by some people as a decent thing for young ladies to be interested in. Leonis the teacher. Yet Leonis' scheme was simple and practical. Its great beauty was that anyone with just little training could learn to identify which class of plant belongs to simply by counting the stamens. To prove his point and to train disciples, Leonis would lead enthusiastic plant spotting hikes through the countryside around Uppsala when he returned there. With groups up to 300, Leonis would roam the fields and woods gathering specimens before marching back to town, accompanied by a band of musicians. Eventually, the rector of the university put up a stop to these hikes, feeling they were distracting students from their studies, saying, quote, we seeds are seriously slow-witted people. We cannot, like others, unite the pleasurable and fun with the serious and useful. But Leonis never stopped short was never short of disciples. The Swedish Garden. So this is interesting. There's a little, finally a little sexual overtone in it. The Swedish Garden settled a firm near Uppsala. Linnaeus created his own botanic garden, laid out in the same order of his Greek classification. There he tried to plant specimens brought to him from around the world. Linnaeus believed that all species of plant existed in God's original Garden of Eden, and had only become scattered since the fall, so it was a pious act to bring them together. Isn't that beautiful? He's so religious and sexual, and it's so amazing. Amazing that St. Newton was religious as well. Linnaeus also believed that Sweden could cater entirely for its own need if an economic plant was grown within its border. Oddly, for such an experienced botanist, he seemed convinced that even tropical plants could survive in Sweden's cool climate. When tender plants perished, he apparently just assumed they were the weak specimens. Throughout the 1740s, Linnaeus worked incredibly hard cataloguing plant species and fitting them into his scheme. In 1745, he published a complete encyclopedia of Swedish plants called Flora Sicuria. As he was working, he began to think about naming the species. The two-name system. The solution did not come easily. He wanted names that were accurate and complete, but simple enough for the amateur to use in their field trips. He felt amateur botanists would remember a genus a species belonged to, and then perhaps one more element to identify the species, and went home and looked it up. This gave him the idea of a two-name binomial system. He was tempted to make a second name quite complex, the fully descriptive of the species, but he realized only needed an easy-to-remember label for the later reference. He resisted the first, calling such names trivial. In 1751, he resumed work on his great project to catalogue the world's plants, and made his decision to put the trivial second name, which was, he said, like putting the clapper on a bell. Realising that he had to get the names and places before someone gave plants other names, he gave a binomial label to every known species. In an incredible burst of invention, Linnaeus succeeded in naming 5,900 plant species in little more than a year. And in 1753, he published them all in the Species Planarium. With his work on the plant kingdom complete, Linnaeus turns his attention to the animal kingdom. In his System Naturae in 1735, he used the classification of quadrupeds, four-legged creatures, but now realized more crucial characteristics than four legs had, the presence of the mammary glands and suckling young. So quadrupeds were replaced by mammals, and the first prime group of mammals was the primates, which he included humans named Homo sapiens wise man. By Linnaeus in 1758, Linnaeus published his catalogues of animals with binomial names in the 10th edition of System Naturae. By now, Linnaeus had many students who would voyage all over the world to bring him samples, while Linnaeus would sit at home waiting for his return like an anxious parent. In 1755, he had turned down an offer for the King of Spain to come and live in Spanish court with a very handsome salary. In 1761, he was granted a royal patent to make him part of the Swedish nobility, and he changed his name to Carl von Lind. 3 years later, a stroke left him hardly weak, and he died in January 1778. Linnaeus's Apostles. Through the 1740s and 50s, many of Linnaeus's best students travelled around the world to investigate and bring back plants from distant islands, lands. These apostles, as Linnaeus called them, were all young, ardent enthusiasts for Linnaeus's botany. True discoverers as comets among the stars, Linnaeus explained proudly. Their mission was often dangerous, and five of them, Alexander Berlin, Pierre Foraski, Frederick Halvusk, and Pierre Loewking, and Christopher Champer never returned. Linnaeus often reproached himself for sending them on their way, but they were all given keen to go, and the plants they brought back were described as hugely enriched Linnaeus's collection. Peter Kam's trip to North America found Linnaeus with 90 species of North American plants, 60 of them entirely new. Peter Orbach brought back 600 specimens from China. Carl Thorenberg described 3,000 from Japan. Bye! And Tollander joined Captain Cook on the Endeavour on his round-the-world voyage and gave names for 1,200 species, 100 new genera of plants. plus a host of animals. By the time Leonard's dies, it was the norm for exhibitions around the world to take botanists with them, culminating, of course, Charles Darwin's famous voyage on the Beagle, where the riches they brought back increased scientific knowledge in the natural world immeasurably. Okay, well, off to a few minutes in, I'm reading James Hutton. I must admit, I have not heard of what Hutton is. I think this is a geologist. Well, here we go. Scotsman James Hutton, 1726 to 97, was a brilliant 18th century geologist who finally revealed the ancient nature of the Earth and the long and gradual process which shapes its landscapes. It seems as though this is a real textbooky, sort of school textbooky thing, that they want to establish their discipline, so they say, they look at these bridging people. Right, see you. It seems so obvious now that the world is very old. It has been shaped by geological processes over millions of years, and it's hard to believe that people did not always see it that way. Even as recently as the 18th century, in the Age of Enlightenment, most people still believe the Earth is not much older than human history. For many people, the truth about the Earth's age lay not in the rocks and the landscape, but in the Bible. In 1650, the Irish Archbishop James Usher gave the official line. Studying the Bible, he concluded the world began on Sunday, the 23rd of October, 4004 BC, and has changed little since, except perhaps during the time of the deluge and the biblical flood, which he dated at 2349 BC. And the great Isaac Newton agreed. Isn't that amazing? Yet, as Copernicus' revelation of the Earth is not the centre of the universe was finally sinking in, so some other thinkers were beginning to question the view of the world, and they could see many rocks and landscapes were formed from sediments in what they were full of fossils of sea creatures. Yet they had no idea how the sediments came to form mountains and how fossils got there. The leading ideas of the 18th century was that it was all a result of a single great catastrophe that shaped the world quickly in one fell swoop and left the landscape as it is. The great German geologist Alban Gottlieb Werner proposed the theory that the catastrophe was a flood. Most rocks, he suggested, formed in a universal ocean that covered the entire Earth, were then left behind as the landscape as we see today, when the oceans and waters drained away. Of course, many saw the biblical deluge in Werner's universal ocean. Hutton's great breakthrough was to show that this idea was wrong in two major geologist Continental Drift. I have to really think what the idea is, what's the name is. Hutton's great breakthrough was to show the idea was wrong in two major respects. First of all, he realised that it was not the flood of waters that formed many of the rocks to build mountains, but the Earth's internal heat, the heat of molten rocks that emerges in volcanoes. Secondly, he showed the landscape were not shaped once and for all by great catastrophe, but slowly, continually, by countless cycles of erosion, sedimentation, uplift, and are repeated over incredibly long time periods. Again and again, he realised the rocks were worn away and their debris washed into the ocean to settle the sediments in the sediments, within uplifted and stored by the heat of the Earth's interior into new landscapes. If this is so, the Earth must be very old, not just thousands of years, but millions. Hutton never stated how old he believed the world to be, but its implication was clear that it was extremely old. Wegener. So there's Werner and Wegener. Is that Wegener? Continental Drift. I should work that up. Scott's upbringing. James Hutton was born in Edinburgh in June 1726, the eldest son of Sarah and Jane William Hutton. William died just 2 years later. Edinburgh was going through an extraordinary time, with the last of the Scottish Highland rebellions turning the city into something of a frontier town. Hutton's childhood, though, was peaceful enough. He was educated in Edinburgh High School. Then, as a teenager at the University of Edinburgh, he came under the eye of Colonel McLaren, who worked with the aging Newton in London and was admired by him. McLaren introduced Hutton to Newton's ideas, notably the cycles of planets, which had marked an influence on him. McLaren, who introduced Hutton to the idea of deism, the idea that God, who designed and created the universe as a perfect machine, that's interesting, then left it to run by itself. The idea played a big part in Hutton's way of thinking and helped him see the idea of the ancient earth did not conflict with the belief in God. There was nothing in James Hutton's life at this time to indicate his later interest in the earth. When he went to university in 1745, he went to medical school to train as a doctor. It was then the same year Charles Sturt, Bonnie Prince Charlie, led the last English rebellion. No doubt, no well-to-do Edinburgh did not approve of the brutality of the Highlanders were treated by the aftermath of Charlie's flight and exile, but it set the city free to flourish in an astonishing way. Elegant new streets were laid out, and the beginnings of an intellectual golden age began. That was to see Edinburgh dubbed the Athens of the North. Oh dear. Was it the Venice of the North is Stockholm? Dr. Hutton Farnham. Yet, even as echoes of the rebellion were ringing in the streets, the young Hutton was obliged to leave the city in embarrassment, having made a young servant girl pregnant, as you do. He went to Paris and studied medicine there for 5 years before completing his medical training in Leiden, Holland. Strangely, though, he never seemed a moment to have contemplated becoming a doctor. In 1750, he went into business with an old Edinburgh friend to make a... to make sal almanac, and sal almanac, and a key ingredient to steel making, whatever that is. And this was to provide him with a moderate income for all his life. Then, in 1750, he inherited a family farm at Slyhouse in south of Edinburgh. He decided to become a farmer. Before he did so, he set out to learn the latest farming techniques and soon turned Slyhouse into one of the most innovative, prosperous farms in Scotland. Hutton's interest in the earth seems to have begun when he was learning about his farm. He travelled extensively around Britain, studying the landscape and rocks to bring sample after sample of rocks and minerals back home. Something quite new those days. He soon seems to have become known for his expertise on them. His close involvement in the land had a crucial influence on his geological ideas. Watching the land on his farm changed year by year, the soil washed away and winter rains only to be replaced through the years as rocks weathered away. He may well have had this inspiration of Hutton's vision of Indus cycles of erosion and renewal. But by the early 1660s, his ideas were already partly formed. So the pregnant girl, and what is it? Sal ammoniac. Ammoniac. Sure, I've got to understand what that is. Returned to Edinburgh. With the farm well established, Hutton moved back to Edinburgh in 1770 and was immediately caught up with the intellectual ferment gripping the city. He had met and befriended, among many other great minds, David Hume, the great philosopher on human nature, Adam Smith, whose book The Wealth of Nations became the Bible for the rise of capitalism, James Watt, who made the steam engine practical, Joseph Black, who discovered carbon dioxide. Black and Watt came... That's amazing. Joseph Black discovered carbon dioxide. And Black and Watt came to be among Hutton's closest friends and supporters. Before long, Hutton and Black teamed up to work on one key problem in geology at a time. Just how did the different minerals of the rocks are made from? What mineralogists of the day believed, like Werner, that they precipitated from the universal ocean? But if this was so, then surely every substance found in the rocks must dissolve in water. This clearly was not the case. During his work with Black, Hutton realised that it was instead the heat from the earth that was involved in mineralisation, not just heat, but heat and extreme pressures. These are only found deep within the earth, going public. Hutton's early ideas began to crystallise, quote-unquote, and this is my idea, and in 1785 he decided to present them to the Royal Society in Edinburgh. Perhaps suffering from stage fright, he left Black to read the paper. Some people were struck at once by the significance of his ideas, while others may have objected that there was no proof. Either way, Hutton was determined to find all the proof needed to convince the doubters, and set off with his friend John Clerk to the Highlands to find it. In particular, Hutton was interested in granite rock, and igneous rock, which forms the molten magma from inside the earth. Hutton wanted to show that outcrops of granite may often form after, not before, the sediments surrounding it. If so, Werner's idea could not be true, and all sediments were formed in the universal ocean were simply laid down on top of primitive igneous rock. In 1788, Hutton's excitement they saw graphic proof he was searching for in Glentilt, the Grampian Mountains, where granite veins were clearly injected into the surrounding rock. Later that summer, Hutton took John Playfair and James Hall to Sikar Point on the North Sea coast to show them the unconformity, sea box unconformity, convincing the world. But if Playfair and Hall could be convinced, there were many who weren't. Hutton's could deal with those who towed the established scientific line and criticised them for lack of understanding. He knew his evidence was sound, and he had many supporters in Edinburgh to back him up. By 1793, a leading Irish academic called Richard Kieran suggested Hutton's theories were blasphemous. Hutton was determined to respond, but the ear feels seriously ill, probably taken with kidney failure. He began to write a book called The Theory of the Earth, explaining his theories and giving up proofs. Unfortunately, he was too ill to make a good job of it, and he was unable to write the last three volumes containing all his proofs. When Hutton died in 1797, his messy book, which is much less clear than his early papers, had little impact. Playfair and Hall took up the score, Playfair writing a simple summary of his ideas, Hall conducting laboratory experiments to show igneous rocks could form crystals simply by cooling down slowly. All the same, it was another 35 years before Giles Lyle wrote a book, famous book, Principles of Geology, in which made Hutton's idea and foundation of modern geology provides Darwin with the preparation for his theory of evolution. Unconformity. A key element of the proof of Hutton's theories was the existence of unconformities, places where there is a clear break in the normal orderly pattern in which rock layers are laid down over time, one on top of the other. In the summer of 1788, Hutton took up two potential critics, John Playfair and James Hall, along the North Sea coast to Sikar Point in a rowing boat. Playfair later described the experience, quote, on us who saw this phenomenon for the first time, the impression will not easily be forgotten. We often said to ourselves, what clear evidence will we have to the different formation of these rocks and the long intervals that separated their formations? Had we actually seen them emerging from the bosom of the deep? What they saw that afternoon was a non-conformity. There was a cliff face with a layer upon layer of rock, not lying horizontally, but standing straight up like books on a shelf. Then, on top of them, cutting across them almost horizontally, were more layers of rocks, this time laying almost flat. This cutting across a non-conformity. It was clear, as Hutton explained to his companions, that the vertical layers were originally laid down flat sediments, then uplifted, tilted almost upright. Erosion had cut across the top of these layers, creating a new plane of seabed. And then the new sediments had gradually settled and built on horizontal layers, which had turned uplifted to create the top of the cliff. No more convincing proof to Hutton's ideas of endlessly repeated cycles of erosion, sedimentations, and uplift could be seen. And Playfair and Hall were instantly became Hutton's most ardent champions. Okay, let's go on to the next one. So that's Hutton. I didn't know about him, but I sort of know about Lyle and all that kind of stuff. Who's this person? Antoine Lavoisier. This is someone I really love. He married a really young chick, got his head chopped off, and was in tax law. If I can say, this tax farming is similar to education farming. We get really incompetent people teaching. Antoine Lavoisier in 1743 to 94 is said to be the father of chemistry, making the first elements, establishing the ideas of conservation of mass and discovering the true nature of the burning wall of oxygen. Good summary. Thanks to Newton and Galileo, scientists of the 18th century knew a lot about how and why things move, but little about things made of chemistry was still closely linked with the alchemists searching for what they called the philosopher's stone, which could turn ordinary base metals into gold. The idea of chemical elements was still in its infancy, and most scientists still believed, as the Greeks had done, there was only four elements: air, water, earth, and fire. At the beginning of the century, alchemists were in some ways still leading the field of study of matter. It was the German alchemist George Stahl, for instance, who came up with the theory to explain how things burned, phlogiston theory. which is to dominate scientific debate for half a century. Stahl suggested anything burned contains a special active substance called phlogiston that dissolves into the air when it burns. Gradually, debate over the nature of matter began to shift towards chemists and more down-to-earth approach, demanding experimentation, close observation, and proofs. In part, this came from Britain, where the impetus of the Industrial Revolution prompted brilliant, high, practically men like Joseph Priestley. I've got a complete mishmash to try their hands at chemical experiments. But the great pioneer was undoubtedly the Frenchman Lavoisier. Lavoisier benefited from the work of British chemists, particularly Priestley, and there have been some arguments over who discovered what. But Lavoisier, who pulled it all together and made many significant advances in its own right. It was Lavoisier, for instance, who realized that every substance can exist in three states, solid, liquid, or gas, and all suggesting that gas is a substance. He opened the way for the idea of why air is not only has mass, but may be a mixture of gases. That Lavoisier, who finally showed that air is a mix of two main gases, oxygen and nitrogen, which he called azote. It was Lavoisier, too, who, with others, showed that water is a compound of two gases, hydrogen and oxygen. And it was Lavoisier who finally proved that phlogiston idea of burning was wrong and gave us the modern theory of combustion. Lavoisier was a meticulous experimenter who championed the notion of exact measurements and the idea of conservation of mass. I.e. he had frozen guinea pigs. I like that idea, frozen guinea pigs. Which was no longer a matter of how substance changed in experiment, no mass was ever lost. The crucial insight was not only helped him prove the true nature of combustion, see box 75, but still underpins all experiments of the matter today. His famous Trait Elementaire de Chim, the chemical treatise on chemical elements, in which he explains clearly for the first time how chemical compounds are formed from elements, he wrote, "We must trust nothing but facts. These are presented to us by nature and cannot deceive. We ought, in every instance, to submit our reason to the test of experiments." And stop here and check on my son.
The young lawyer. The eldest son of a lawyer, Jean-Antoine Lavoisier, and Émile Pouctis Antoine Lavoisier, was born into Paris in the, born in Paris on the 26th of August 1743. His mother died when he was three, and he was then brought up by an adoring aunt, Clamisse Punctis. The Punctis family were very wealthy, and so the young Antoine was brought up in the comfort and went to the elite college Murzan, where he studied both science and law. His legal training undoubtedly helped him present his arguments clearly, but also alerted him to the need for proofs. In his spare time, he attended lectures on chemistry. Isn't that beautiful, that connection between law and science? When Lavoisier graduated as a lawyer in 1763, he went with a friend of the family, geologist Jean-Étienne Guettard, on a trip through France cataloguing minerals. Then, on 1765, using his newly acquired chemical and mineralogical knowledge, he presented a report to the Academy of Sciences in Paris on the nature of gypsum, which is used to make plaster of Paris. A common thread throughout Lavoisier's life was the interest in public works, and when he was admitted to the Academy of the following year, as a young age of 23, It was partly a brilliant paper on the way to light the streets of Paris. It was about the time that he received a large inheritance from his mother, and he used it to buy an interest in a company called the General Farm. The farm was a company that paid the government money, but in return was allowed to collect taxes. It was a sound financial investment, and it helped him make Lavoisier wealthier. But it would also prove in time to be his downfall, for the tax farmers were very unpopular with the people. The farm also brought Lavoisier his wife, Anne-Marie Pinerette Polaise, a pretty 13-year-old daughter of another tax farmer. Despite the... hello, Sebastian. Despite the age difference, Lavasi was almost 30 when they married. It proved a happy marriage. Marie-Anne proved a more than capable scientific assistant, not just helping Lavoisier in his laboratory, but taking drawing lessons from the famous painter Jacques-Louis David, so she could illustrate his work, and learning English in order to translate the works of British scientists for him. Lavoisier in the laboratory. That's interesting that Marie-Anne learned. Isn't it amazing that people could do that sort of thing? And we are now in an age with so much intense education that we know nothing. Lavoisier in the laboratory. Lavoisier's wealth meant that he would build himself what he was perhaps the best equipped chemistry laboratory of the age, and began to undertake a series of important experiments. First of all, he began to try out the phlogiston theory, testing burning sulfur, phosphorus, and other chemicals. He suggested a new theory that when things burn, they do not give off phlogiston but take in air. This wasn't the whole truth, but it was a magnificent step, and he decided to investigate the finding of the British scientists with the various substances in air. His idea was that with the aid, quote, to link... It's getting very dark here, so I've got the book close to my face. Our knowledge of air that goes into combustion or liberated from substances with other acquired knowledge and to form a theory. And his efforts were successful, bringing him to what is essentially now the accepted theory of combustion, see the box, air and water. In 1774, the English chemist Joseph Priestley, who was, in fact, training to be a priest but couldn't be one, was watching what strong heat could do to mercuric oxide, and what he could do is he had a magnifying glass which went through and so he could see it. He did notice that it gave off gas and that, to his surprise, a candle would burn in that gas in an unusually strong flame. On his visit to Paris the following year, he met Lavoisier, who told him about this phenomenon. Lavoisier once did a series of experiments with the new gas and with air. Lavoisier learned that the air is made up of two gases. Firstly, Priestley gases, another involved in combustion, which Lavoisier called oxygen, and secondly, a gas which came to be called nitrogen, which he was called azote. That's interesting. Although this is now forgotten, Lavoisier wrongly coined the word oxygen from the Greek of acid forming, which oxygen isn't. So his idea was that you form acids with oxygen, which is almost true. Like if you burn sulfur, you make sulfuric acid. Even more importantly, Lavoisier went on to show the burning is closely related to breathing. This is the guinea pig experiment. And that both involve oxygen. Out of the lungs, well, Priestley did that by starving his mouse in a cage. Our lungs take in the oxygen we need from the air and expel carbon dioxide. He also showed that oxygen reacts with metals and form oxide. I did remember there was this chap who discovered carbon dioxide. I can't remember it. It's gone from my head. A process called oxidization, rusting, rotting organic matter and burning wood are all the same kind as all kinds of oxidation. Not content, Lavoisier went on to experiment with water. Priestley and the other British scientists, such as Henry Cavendish, had already noted that oxygen and hydrogen could be changed into develops when electric sparks threw them together. Lavoisier identified the dew as water and showed that it was created by the joining of hydrogen and oxygen. It's getting very dark here, so I don't know how much I can read. Lavoisier was aware how important the work was, and was determined to show that he was establishing a new field of science, experimental chemistry. Firstly, in 1787, he published a method for naming chemicals according to their properties. Okay, reading closer still, and a system of symbols that shortened them. Of chemicals that we still use today. Secondly, he wrote a major summary of the field in his Traité élémentaire
chemistry of 1789. So it's interesting that he is really the founder of chemistry. How we've got this, we have a new way of writing things, as shorthand. Social science and the revolution. While the laboratory work was important, Lavoisier was also very concerned with more practical projects. Through the 1770s and 80s, Lavoisier conducted a whole series of studies and accompanied almost 200 separate reports on the huge range of... It's the light's getting too dim at the moment. Let's see if I can turn it to the dying sun to get some more. Oh, that's better. There's the dying sun. See how much I could get. The huge range of issues, including local adulteration, or food adulteration, how dyes work, how water could be stored aboard a ship, how glass could be made better, how prisons could be improved, whether canal water could be drunk, and much more besides. He approached such each of these with the same thoroughness and insight that he did with his laboratory work, and made many genuine improvements in social conditions. All this, however, would not help him when the revolution came. In the terror of 1793, Jean-Paul Marval came to power, and the revolutionaries decided that it was the turn to pay off old scores, particularly against those who had profited from the old regime, as the unpopular tax farmers had done. Lavoisier was tried and found guilty, and when his achievements of science were brought to the attention of the judge, in the attempt of his friends to save him, the judge said to have replied, "The public has no need for scientists." Lavoisier, who was guillotined on the 8th of May, 1794, a witness to the event, the furious, famous mathematician Joseph Louis Lagrange, commented, "It took more than an instant. It took a mere instant to cut off the head, and yet another 100 years not to produce another one like it." Okay, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful in terms of writing? Now, I'll see in a very dim light, which I'm left here. I've got the next person here is John Dalton, another person I find interesting. Priestley is interesting. I'd want to know Dalton again. Read it here. Phlogiston and burning. So it's very, very dim light, and which is really great for me reading because I can't see the words and my brain has to really work. This is almost perfect. The phlogiston debate was quite... I really can't read it. So I have to go off. Phlogiston is a very interesting topic, and we don't know how long this has all lasted for. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.